Again, thank you all for coming out this evening. As I said, I want to basically analyze the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa like a short story. Right? A short story in literature where you read the whole thing and you analyze it on a few different levels. On the character level, on the plot level, on the theme level. Those are sort of the main ideas. And I think when we get to going through all of those issues and we get to the themes at the end, they're going to say a whole bunch of things that are related to our communities and the way that we act. But first, we're going to go through the text again. You know, everybody read this already, and a lot of people have seen this before even. But there were a lot of things that are unclear, some of it just because it's Aramaic, some of it because Gemara is often unclear when it uses pronouns, either on purpose to make points that are complicated and complex, or sometimes just because that's how it is and it's our luck that we get to struggle through it as people who learn Torah. So, we're going to read the first half of the story. Akamsa ubar kamsa charuv Yerushalayim. Jerusalem was destroyed because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Even this introduction, once you know what's going to happen, is a little bit odd, given that 50% of the people in the title do not show up in the story, right? You guys already know we're not going to meet Kamsa. He doesn't come to the party. What does happen? There's Dahu Gavra, Derachme Kamsa, Ubal Debave Bar Kamsa. There is a guy whose name we don't know, who has a friend named Kamsa and an enemy named Bar Kamsa. This anonymous host is one of the reasons for the complicated pronoun issues that came up in the text. And because I keep thinking of him as a host, I'm going to call him Alex Trebek, because that was the first host that came into my mind when I thought of that word. But you guys can call him whatever you want. So, Alex has a friend named Kamsa and an enemy named Bar Kamsa, and Avatsu Data. He was throwing a party. Amar li lishane zil aiti li Kamsa. He tells his servant, who doesn't have a name, but that's less surprising because servants in the Gemara rarely have names, so it's less surprising. He tells his servant, please bring me Kamsa, azil aiti li Bar Kamsa, but he brought Bar Kamsa instead. I saw a funny picture that I actually wanted to put on the source sheet that had like an autocorrect where someone's texting. Oh, you saw it also? Yes, okay, I was going to put that on the source sheet and it came out weird. You can pass it around. Of a guy like texting in an iPhone, don't forget to invite Kamsa, and it autocorrects to Bar Kamsa. And so that's how it started. So it was going around the internet. I think it made some friends. Okay, that's a really great point, right? It's not clear how this happened, right? Was the servant just
stupid,
not paying attention? Was the servant trying to cause trouble? We have no particular reason to think the servant was trying to cause trouble. It sounds like it was some sort of mistake, but it's a mistake that happens when you're careless, right? There's already somebody who's just not doing his job right. So, Alex shows up to his party. He shows up and he sees Bar Kamsa at his party. Amrlei, he says to him, Mirte haku gavra bal debava de haku gavra hu, my bai hafa, kum pok. He says, since this man, you, is this man, me's enemy, what are you even doing at the party? Get up and leave. And this is actually somewhat of a good question, because if you're Bar Kamsa, when you got the invitation to the party from your enemy, what were you thinking? Why does he think he's invited to the party? Okay, so it sounds like Bar Kamsa sort of had hope, right? Maybe something good was going to come of this. Maybe, you know, Alex was putting their difficulties behind them. But he shows up and, you know, his enemy can't think of why possibly he would even have shown, right? If you're not in the mood to reconcile with somebody, it's just incomprehensible to you why someone else would think you're even trying to be nice to them. I hate you. Why would you even think I was being nice? And this is a good point to pause and acknowledge what everybody here realized, which is we don't know why these men hate each other. Right? We have no backstory. It's just a fact on the ground. There's a guy with a friend and a guy who he hates. And it raises the question, maybe they hated each other for a really good reason, right? Maybe Bar Kamsa did something terrible, right? Maybe, you know, there, maybe this isn't baseless hatred, right? We sort of, one of the things we'll talk about is that this story is kind of a paradigm of sinachinam. Baseless hatred is the reason the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. But the hatred at the beginning of the story, while we don't know the base, isn't, you know, being said as this guy hated someone for absolutely no reason. There seems to be like some real deep problems between these men. And it almost raises the question of, you know, when you hate somebody, even if it's for a good reason, bad things happen, right? It doesn't need to be a terrible reason to hate someone for something negative to happen because of that. So that's something to keep in the back of your mind as we continue.
There's also an interesting, I mean, when you talk about that, I mean, it's the fact that Bar Kamsa was capable of doing what he did just because of that could also mean that he came to the party just to upset him.
Okay, you're saying we see from the end of the story that Bar Kamsa is not a good guy. Mm-hmm. And who knows, you know, what was going through his mind when he shows up. So
the host doesn't necessarily know about the inherent mutation, right? Like,
that's true, he doesn't know how he ended up. Right. He's also annoyed because his friend hasn't come to his party, right? He's probably in a bad mood because he can't find the guy who he wanted to invite. And now this guy's here and like the night just keeps getting worse and worse. So he tries to make Bar Kamsa leave. Right? He says to him, but Bar Kamsa says, Amar lei, ho'il va'atai shavkan v'yahiv nalach d'mei ma'adachil na'vishatina. He says, look, I'm already here. Let me stay, and I'll pay for what I'm eating and drinking. Bar Kamsa thinks that Alex's problem with him is that he wasn't invited to the party, and he's eating and drinking. It costs him money. He thinks it's a problem that money can solve. He says, Amar lei, well, okay, he says, no, I'm not interested in you paying for just, you know, what you've done. So he thinks, okay, it's a problem more money can solve. Amar lei, yahiv nalach d'mei palga d'su datif. He says, I'll pay for half of this whole party. Amar lei, lo. He says, I'm not interested. Amar lei, yahiv nalach d'mei kula su datif. He says, I'll pay you for the entire party. Just don't make me leave. Amar lei, lo. He says, no. This, to me, is the part where I actually have a bit of pity for Bar Kamsa, because he really seems to be, like, so worried about the embarrassment that's going to happen if he gets kicked out of this party, that suddenly the bad guy here is the host, right? I don't care that you don't like the guy, right? He's begging you to be able to stay, and you're kicking him out, and that's exactly what he does. Nakte biyade v'okme v'afke. Every single one of those words is essential. He grabbed him in his hands, he lifted him and he physically removed him from the party. Or the English translation says he took him by the hand and picked him up. This is literally being thrown out of the party, right? It escalates, right? He doesn't just say like, okay, now it's time to go. It was a physical altercation. Amar, ho'il v'hadu yatve rabbanan v'lo mahube, shma mina kanicha lehu. Bar Kamsa says to himself, there were rabbis at this party. That's new information. We didn't know that before. But he says, the rabbis saw what happened. They didn't intervene. It must mean they're totally fine with me being kicked out of the party. Ezel Echol Behu Kortza Beimalka says, I'm going to go tell on them. I'm going to go tattle to the Caesar. Just a bit of historical context. We're talking about the years, you know, leading up to the year 70 CE, which is when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. Israel was under Roman occupation. The Romans were letting the Jews continue mostly doing what they were doing. There was a Beit HaMikdash. There was still, Jews had religious sovereignty, but they didn't truly have political sovereignty anymore. There were Roman soldiers, you know, stationed throughout the land. They collected taxes. So there was a very, very tenuous balance going on. And it's also worth pointing out that this is a time period in Jewish history that was mainly demarcated by sectarianism. It was a time where there was not unity among the Jewish people. When Josephus, the historian, who we'll see later in the source sheet, describes the Jewish nation at the end of the period of Bayit Sheni, he describes the Jewish people as being broken up into groups. That's like the way he talks about societies, all of the groups. One of the groups, a whole bunch of Jews who were followers of this guy Jesus, who were basically still somewhat connected to the Jewish people at this time. They were just, like, doing some weird other things, right? There were a main breakdown between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, the Sadducim and the Purim. The Purim were the rabbis, mainly. They were the people who had the tradition of Torah Shebaal Peh and the tradition of development of halacha that is basically the way that we practice Judaism today. That was like the rabbinic community. And then the Sadducim were generally the elite of society. They were less focused on text, but they were very influential in the Beit HaMikdash. Many of the Kohanim were from the Tzaddiki community, so there were actually a lot of tensions there. I could talk about this for a long time because it's really fascinating. But what's important to know is that this was a time that wasn't that didn't have unity among the Jewish people, and also the unity was not just religious but political as well. There were major debates among the Jews whether they should try to rebel against the Romans and kick them out of Israel or not. The main people to know in that discussion are the Zealots. The Zealots were the group of Jews who ended up really involved in the rebellion against Rome. That rebellion, the Great Jewish Revolt, ends in the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash in the year 70. But it's important to know all of this to be able to understand how Bar Kamsa, a Jewish guy, goes to the Romans to try to tattle on the rabbis. Right? This isn't a time where the assumption is all the Jews at the party are part of the same, you know, they all vote the same way, they all share the same opinions. Now that I think about it, no group of Jews ever really has that level of unity that I'm sort of talking about. But still, it's not completely surprising that Bar Kamsa is going to take this into the political realm. Okay, this is the first half of the story. This is sort of the, this is the part of the story that is always taught to kids in camp during the 9 days, because it has a really good lesson, right? Don't be mean to people. Don't kick them out of parties. If you kick them out of parties, they might go tattle on you, and the Beit HaMikdash might end up being destroyed. It's a good lesson, right? I'm really not knocking that lesson. It's a really important one.
I don't even
one.
Think they get to the tattling. The
it's just, don't kick
people out.
Each
other. God
destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. You're right. Even the last sentence isn't in the story when you're a kid. You're right. I divided it in the wrong place if I was trying to divide it like that. But you're right. There's a way of telling the story where Sinat Chinam causes God to intervene. But I think it's actually more interesting that Sinat Chinam actually has ramifications in real life, right? In a way that you can see practically. You actually see the outcome here. Yeah, absolutely, right? You can actually cause problems in the world all on your own. You don't even need to wait for God to punish you. You can punish yourself if you act inappropriately enough. It can come back to bite you in that way. So that's the first half of the story. So just to review, who's to blame for what went wrong here? Okay, what are our options?
The host.
Okay, the host. What did he do wrong?
He should have let him stay.
The servant. He's the guy who messed up.
He's not to blame.
He's careless. You don't want to take it too far, but it's a piece of information that's given to us, right? We don't just hear it was some sort of mistake. We hear, like, that there was a person involved, which just sort of starts the cycle from, like, the most prosaic level to the most essential level, right? The person who, like, literally it's his fault, the person who actually started it off with just, like, a little mistake, a little act of autocorrect, to the people who actually had, like, real problems that caused these issues. So who else is at fault?
The
rabbis.
And the other innocent bystanders, the people who are not saying anything.
Other innocent bystanders. Right.
Or not so innocent.
Or not so innocent. Yeah, people who didn't prevent this from happening.
From escalating.
Yeah. And then there's Bar Kamsa.
Sure.
What did he do wrong?
He should have. So the question is,
he shouldn't have gone to his room.
Well, he should have shown up to the party as one possibility. The other possibility. Of course he should have gone to the Romans. That kind of almost goes without saying.
Or left quietly.
Right, he could have left at the beginning. There's this, like, major miscommunication about why he's being asked to leave. Right? Like, he really thinks that he can convince the host not to kick him out. And I actually think that this is the part of the story that's actually best described as sinat kinam, as baseless hatred, because when the host refuses to accept even this enormous monetary, like, bribe to allow this guy to stay, that is where it goes, like, above and beyond. Like, fine, you don't like this guy. He's offering to pay for your whole party, and you're so beyond rationality that you can't imagine letting him stay, right?
On the other hand, again, we don't know the reason. And when I haven't been focused on the monetary piece until I heard you reading it, and suddenly I thought, who knows, maybe this Bar Kamsa is even wealthier, and there's a financial dispute, and it's almost offensive to hear him offering money.
Well, that's so interesting.
I mean, you just don't know what's going on.
Huh. Or maybe it's people to whom money doesn't matter at all. Maybe they're all so rich that it's, like, that it's silly. But I think that the fact that the story, like, details all of this just elevates the responsibility of everybody, right? Bar Kamsa is getting more and more desperate that he's making ridiculous offers, right? The host is so ensconced in hatred that he can't accept even this ridiculous offer. Nobody looks particularly good in the first half of the story. In the second half of the story, it just gets worse. In the second half of the story, things sort of explode in a way that I really don't think most people would have expected. Azal Amar Leila Kesar. So we're in the second source, which is the direct continuation of the first source. I just broke it in two so that you could read them separately, but it's the direct continuation. Bar Kamsa goes to the Caesar and says, Mardu Bach Yehudai, the Jews are rebelling against you. And this is a thing that the Romans were actively concerned about. So it made sense that this is a claim he was going with, even though it wasn't actually true. Amar Leh Mi Yemar. So he says, how do I know? Where are you bringing this from? Amar Leh Shadar Lehu Kurbana. He says, okay, we'll do a test. Why don't you send a carbon for the Jews to bring in the Beit HaMikdash? Ima carbon lay, azil shadar biat. Okay, ima carbon lay. And you'll see if they bring it or not. And just to point out, this wasn't such a weird thing to do, given that the Romans were letting the Jews continue worshiping in the Beit HaMikdash. They did, I think, sometimes send sacrifices to be brought in that Beit HaMikdash. The pasuk says, ki beiti beit tefilai yikarei l'chol ha'amim. The ideal is that theoretically the Beit HaMikdash will be a place where all nations can worship God. It never really got to that ideal, but there's nothing offensive about the Romans sending a sacrifice just as long as it's good, which it was when they sent it out. Azal shadar biyadei egla tlata. So he sends him with a 3-year-old cow. Bahade dekaati shada be muma beniv svatayim ramrila bedokin shebaayim. On the way, Bar Kamsa wounds the cow, either on its lip or on its eye, in such a way that the Jews would not be able to sacrifice it because it would be considered wounded, but the Romans would not have considered it something that would prevent it from being brought as a carbon.
Well, Caesar didn't even know that he did that. That was
it. Right. So there is somewhat of a question here, like, how involved are the Romans in this process?
Did he send someone along who was watching all this?
I think you need to assume either that there was somebody else there, or that they were sure that word was going to get back, or that there were going to be Roman soldiers when he got to Israel. It's not totally clear, but I think that that's sort of an assumption that you need to make, that it was going to be known. I'm open to all suggestions about what the mechanism for that was.
I mean, you just put yourself in the shoes of, and this guy is coming and tattling to the Romans, and the Romans really want to know if it's true or not. Why would they, it's like, why would they give the animal to him to take by himself? I would assume that they would have sent somebody else. I mean, he definitely has,
Because they're waiting to see the outcome. They're not just sending him on his way.
Right, but, why would they trust him?
But then the rabbis, when they're considering what to do afterwards, they say, but maybe we should kill him so that word doesn't get back. So that would suggest that Bar Kamsa is actually on his own at this point. And without him being able to convey that the Jews did refuse the sacrifice.
Right. I, I think that there's a possibility that, like, I don't know, when I imagine it in my head, I sort of imagine Bar Kamsa has, like, a letter with him, like, for the Romans in Jerusalem, like, that he's supposed to report to, I don't know, the, like, local mercenary soldiers or whatever it is. In that, it needs to get back.
If he claimed that they weren't going to sacrifice this, then this particular sacrifice was probably being watched.
Yeah. Right, and right. They couldn't switch out the cow.
This was a some sort of test. You know?
And they would know that there's a conflict of interest if the guy is coming and you know, and tattling, so to speak. He's got an agenda. I mean, it was many hundreds of years ago, but people were not stupid. I would think.
Okay, so let's go to the to the dilemma that the rabbis are faced with, right? They get this animal that they can't bring. So they say, well, we know that there's danger here. Maybe we should just bring the carbon anyway. Because of Shlom Malchut, because of peace with the government, maybe we have no choice. We should just do it. And this guy, who we haven't heard before, Rabbi Zacharia ben Avkulas, says, we can't do it for a technical halachic reason. Yomru ba'alei mumim krivin ligabe mizbeach. People will think that you're allowed to bring a korban with a mum on the mizbeach, right? It'll be a free-for-all of wounded animals on the mizbeach. So then they say, okay, sever l'miktalei. Maybe we should just kill Bar Kamsa. And you're right, it's not entirely clear how this would have solved the problem or how they even suggested this, but the insanity of that suggestion is only followed in insanity by the reason Rabbi Zacharia says not to do it. Rabbi Zacharia says don't kill him, not because killing him is crazy, but because then people will think if you wound an animal that's meant to be a korban, then we kill you. He has this, like, again, this worry that people are going to get the wrong halachic impression from this story. Okay? What happens in the end? Nothing. Right? Rabbi Zacharia rejects all of the options given by the rabbis, which leads to them not bringing the korban, which leads to the Romans actually saying, yeah, the Jews are rebelling, sending troops to Jerusalem, and leading up to what becomes the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. The end of the story gives us another person to blame. Rabbi Yochanan says, "Anvatnuto shel Rabbi Zacharia ben Avkulas hachriva et beitenu v'sarfat v'chalenu v'higlitanu me'artzenu." The humility of Rabbi Zacharia ben Avkulas destroyed our Beit HaMikdash and burned our holy place and exiled us from our land. Extremely dramatic statement, blaming everything on Rabbi Zacharia and his humility. Okay, there's something very odd about this, because, yeah, Rabbi Zacharia does seem to have done something that, you know, kind of messed stuff up, but how is that related to humility? What does that have to do with anything? Did anybody come up with suggestions as they were learning it? What does this mean?
No,
what
did
you say?
Well, I read some of the sources.
Okay, good. Exactly as you're supposed to.
I think it's really the Tosefta that sheds light on it.
Yeah. So the first source that comes after this Gemara was brought only to strengthen the question. The Gemara in Shalva says, "Lo'olam yehei adam anvatan kehillel va'al yehei kapdan kishamai." A person should always be an anavtan like Hillel, humble like Hillel, and not impatient like Shammai. Or you could translate kapdan in other ways, impatient or caring about the little things or just generally something negative. And anavtan is obviously a positive thing. That's something you're supposed to do. Okay, so how is this a bad thing? The next sources that I realized were a little bit out of context. I should have given a little bit more information. The Gemara has a debate what time you have to daven by. They say you should you should hold like the Vatikin. Vatikin back then wasn't a time for davening, but was a group of people who thought you need to daven early in the morning. They were the group of guys who davened earliest. And Rashi explains the word Vatikin by saying Anashim Anavim Umechavavim Mitzvah. They were humble and they loved mitzvot. Okay? I brought this because it's very interesting to see those two words connected. Rashi seems to think that there's a connection between humility and loving mitzvot, which is interesting when you look at the Tosefta. The Tosefta is the next place, it might be the only other place that we see Rabbi Zechariah ben Afkilus. If not, then it's one of the only other places. And it's very interesting. It relates to a debate between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai about how you deal with scraps of food on Shabbos. Scraps of food that are like bones and peels that are not edible anymore. Should they be considered muktzah? Right? Maybe if they're not useful, then you can't even move them. So, Beit Hillel says you can pick up the bones and peels from your table after the meal and you can throw them out like usual. But Beit Shammai says, no, you can't actually pick it up. You have to like shake off the tray that they're on or shake off the tablecloth. You can't actively pick them up because they are muktzah. But Rabbi Zechariah ben Afkilus could not decide who he wanted to paskin like. So, as he was eating, he would just, like, throw the garbage under his chair. Okay, it says couch, because we're talking about a time where people ate, like, sort of reclining on couches. But he would sort of get around the problem by not letting himself make any food garbage. And here again...
I even read, not that he couldn't decide who to go by, but that, like, as if... Neither was good enough for him.
Yeah,
that's
what I thought.
He was such a charedi that he wanted to paskin more strictly.
More strictly than both of them. That's so interesting. I also see that the English translation that I brought from somewhere else actually seems to lead to that impression when it says, so as not to have to remove the items by any method later on.
I interpreted it more like you. Like, this is kind of what I think in the beginning, and then when I read this, I was thinking the same thing, and then even the next thing, which is the second version of the story, which is like this kind of boot is more like indecisiveness, that like Edith is so indecisive. Like, so it's good to like weigh all the options, like when you're thinking about a woman's foot and how to pass them, but like ultimately you have to come to this. Act upon it. Whereas, like, his shortcoming was, like, weighing everything so much to the extent it just led to.
Yeah, that's how I read this Tosefta, because even Beit Shammai, he doesn't say you have to leave it there forever, but that's only because even in Hilchot Shabbos, if you do have something that's muktzah that's on your table, you are allowed to shake it off. There's no, even if you have, I don't know, like you have your cell phone on your Shabbos table, you are allowed to, like, find a way to remove that if it's not something that's supposed to stay there. Right? So it's not like Beit Shammai is giving a kula. Beit Shammai is the serious chumrah in this case. And Rabbi Zechariah is doing an in-between thing because he is physically throwing the waste. He's just refusing to put it down on the table because if you leave it there, then at the end of the meal, you have to paskin either like Beit Shammai or like Beit Hillel. I see why you disagree.
Also, the source about the Vatikin, that influenced me as well, because I'm thinking, okay, maybe there's something about Anvatnut that like if there's a humbleness to placing the mitzvah above you at all times, placing value of the mitzvah that, you know, I'm going to wake up the crack of dawn, I'm going to put the mitzvot above anything else in my life, that's what the Vatikin do. Because they love mitzvot.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what the Vatikin do.
And maybe that's what Rav Zechariah then...
Yes, I think you're right. But I think the thing he does, the way he shows his love of mitzvot, is by refusing to do anything that might be wrong.
Like in the previous story.
Yeah.
I actually read the Rashi as saying anavah, like anavah is separate from love of mitzvah, because if anavah included love of mitzvah, then Rashi would just be repeating himself. But it's actually two separate terms, and that's why we are able to listen to the Vatikin in terms of Shema. And that's why we do, like some people do, Davin and Vatikin. But that anavim is actually a separate thing from love of mitzvot, and so Rabbi Zechariah had anavah, but he didn't necessarily have the love of mitzvot, so he wasn't even doing it So, like, the way I was reading all of this was that he's almost, like, I was talking to Abby, I was saying, like, maybe he's almost like a chesed shota. Like, he's like, I'm going to, like, it's not even, like, what, this for the sake of the mitzvah, it's just how good, not, this isn't exactly what I want to say, but how am I going to appear adhering so closely to all of these things? And it also stood out in my mind that they listened to him, and that also that he, like, he was a sole voice against the, like, the robe of the rabbis, and yet his decision somehow, like, impacted the final decision when we actually learn from other stories, like the story with the gospel coming down from Shemayim, that it doesn't matter what one person says, even if they are technically correct, even if Hashem agrees with them, if the robe of the rabbis say one thing, that's what you do. And here he was putting himself, he was framing himself as such a humble man, like, oh, but actually all of this might happen, oh, but I'm going to take on the voice, like, speak for the people.
That's really interesting.
But
okay, so what you're saying is, like, is a really good read that I hadn't thought about. Let's pass some. I think there's some more story. Oh, we'll have over there. I think what you're saying is a really interesting read. It doesn't change what I think the essential problem with Rabbi Zachariah is. What I think the essential problem with Rabbi Zachariah is his fear of getting it wrong that leads to a paralysis in decision-making, and specifically in halacha, meaning that what he says is the problem in the karban issue is not that this isn't the right decision. It's that halachically, people might then think something that's incorrect, right? We can't let them bring a karban that's not perfect because people might think that that's allowed, right? And we can't let them kill bar mitzvah because people might think that that's the halacha, right? And it seems to me like he's just afraid that anyone will ever think anything is a halacha, right? If somebody on Shabbos sees Rabbi Zachariah pick up his bones from the table, they'll say, Rabbi Zachariah paskins like Beit Hillel, right? But maybe he's not sure he's supposed to paskin like Beit Hillel. So it seems to me like he refuses to be a model for anybody, right, in doing anything because it might be wrong, so better not to.
Which makes you wonder why everybody listens to him with the bar mitzvah.
That's the irony.
Right.
That's the irony.
I mean, indecision is also a decision.
Right, and I think you see that the rabbis were swayed by indecision because it's easier not to do anything, right? The end of the story just stops. Right? We don't actually hear, so then the rabbis decided, okay, we're not going to do it. To me, it feels like that point where they realized that they were afraid to take a vote. Right? I get this, like, vision of the rabbis sitting around, and they're having this debate, and they're leaning towards making a decision, and then Rabbi Zachariah says, no, but if we do that, then it'll lead to something, and I feel like they were all like, okay, let's just go home. Right? Like, we're not going to be able to vote against his claim of not doing something because it's safer not to do something. So he, like, convinced them of that somehow.
And it's like in the second version of the story where it says that he was sitting
yes.
there. And
for people who didn't read it, tell everybody what the second version of the story is.
So
the
in
next
the second
source.
Version of the story, that's on the...
It's source number seven. It's the version of the story told in the Medrash on Eicha. And there's one major difference that Abby's going to tell us.
Rabbi Zachariah as being like the rabbi who's sitting there and didn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because as like once I was thinking, oh, this is his problem, and then as we were all like debating like whose fault was it in the party, what was the right thing to do, I was kind of like envisioning him like sitting there and not being able to like intervene because he couldn't take decisive action about like who was right, what's the right thing to do here. So just let it play out.
Right, exactly. Because if in the fight between the host and Bar Kamsa, we don't know who was right, right? We don't know why they hate each other. It's still wrong for the host to kick Bar Kamsa out of the party. But you hear Rabbi Zacharia think, but if I say something, people will think that I'm on Bar Kamsa's side in this fight, and I don't want to take a position on this. So I'm just going to sit back. And yet we see exactly what that led to. And fascinatingly, in this version of the story, Rabbi Zacharia doesn't get involved because he doesn't want to take a position. So then Bar Kamsa goes and does all of these things that lead to, again, Rabbi Zacharia being put in the same position of having to make a harder decision, right? Now it's a much more difficult thing because it's not whose side are you on, the host or Bar Kamsa. Now it's, should we bring this korban or should we let the Romans destroy the Beit HaMikdash? And again, his inability to make a decision, right? Which is humility in a way, right?
Well, in the second case, it says, since the other rabbis didn't say anything, he wasn't going to say anything. So that's kind of a, you know, disposition of humility of like saying, you know,
he went out and thought in the second version, that's Bar Kamsa. That's,
oh, okay.
Rabbi Zacharia is one of those aged rabbis.
But those other rabbis, again, went along with him.
Again, right. He's like the leader of not doing anything. Which
they
is,
all follow.
Right, they all follow him because if he's not doing anything. And I think that this is like the question of humility. That I realized something when we talk about Hillel and Shammai, right? We say you're supposed to be an Anav like Hillel and not a Kapdan like Shammai. The question is, what is an Anav? So Rabbi Zacharia clearly thought that being an Anav is not taking a stand, right? It's saying, like, who am I to make that decision? Who am I to get involved? But Hillel clearly did not have that definition. In another Gemara about a Bat Kol, we have a really great Gemara in Erevin, where the question finally comes down, do we paskin halacha like Beit Hillel or like Beit Shammai? Right? There's a major just split in Jewish paskining of halacha because there were so many debates. And so God finally came out and said, you know what? Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. You guys are all learning Torah in a really good way. Everybody has validity in what they're saying. But we're going to paskin like Hillel. Why do we paskin like Hillel? Because when they teach halacha, they teach the halacha of Shammai first, okay? They say, okay, how do you build a sukkah? So Shammai says you build a sukkah this way, and we say you build a sukkah that way. But if Hillel was an anav like Rabbi Zacharia, he would just teach the halacha of Shammai, right? If Rabbi Zacharia were Hillel, and he were saying, who am I to have a right? It would lead to not saying your own opinion at all. But Hillel...
Or it would lead to... saying some say this,
right.
Some say that.
Okay, great. That's almost worse. But that's not what Beit Hillel did, right? Hillel said, I will teach the opinion of my friends because I respect his learning, but I will tell you what I actually think. And that is the way that you're supposed to be humble, right? Not Rabbi Zacharia's humility, but Hillel's humility. Okay, that was the analysis of the Rabbi Zacharia character based on this, like, strange word. There's one other thing that I want to use to look at this story. I know we have, like, 3 minutes left, basically. But I mentioned before that this is a period of sectarianism among the Jewish people. And there are a few interesting ways that manifested itself. The same medrash in Eicha Rabbah that has this story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa darshans on a pasuk in Eicha that one of the problems among the Jewish people was that they were so, like, either self-confident or self-aware that they wouldn't go to a party unless they knew who else was at that party. They wouldn't eat with people who weren't, like, of their kind or of their level. And you see that in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that actually this wasn't seen as such a bad thing, that... rabbis wouldn't sign on, that people wouldn't sign on as witnesses to a legal document unless they knew who the other people were who were witnessing with them. And this relates to a lot of these divisions in society where people were worried about associating with other groups, right? That you were worried that you would sign on a document and the other person who signed on would be from a group that you disagree with, and you'd be tarnished by association, or something would be invalidated. So there was this desire to distance yourself from people who were different than you. Which raises, you know, which adds this whole other level to the question of what do you do when somebody shows up to your party who wasn't invited? Because if your whole way of living life is to make sure that the kashrus is up to this standard and you only associate with people who dress like this and all of those different issues, you end up with somebody being violently kicked out of a party, right? That's what happens when you raise your standards to such a point that a typo leads to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And so finally, in Josephus's history of the wars of the Jews, where he talks about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, he talks about those zealots who I mentioned earlier. And very interestingly, he lists the two men who were the leaders of the zealots who were attempting to foment rebellion against Rome from within the Jewish community. Last source says, these leaders were Elazar, the son of Simon, who seemed the most plausible man of them all, both in considering what was fit to be done and in the execution of what he had determined upon, and Zacharias, the son of Amphipolus. It's a really familiar name, right? There is a whole nother way of reading the story in a completely political way in which Rabbi Zachariah actually wanted to cause trouble with Rome. I could go into like all the ways that would influence back everything that we've just said. But what I think this does for us at the end of the day is the leaders of the zealots, who were the Jews who wanted to rebel against Rome, even from before this story started. Right, so there's this whole version of events in which this was all kind of on purpose, right? In which Rabbi Zachariah would want the Jews to end up in a position where they needed to defend themselves against the Romans. It was a terrible political decision, right? It ended up really, really not working, but they didn't know that. They thought that they could, you know, end up in a point of Jewish sovereignty over the whole land of Israel, and they thought it was worth trying. It turned out not to be. What does this end up with? It ends up with a few really, really powerful lessons for me. Number one is the two halves of the story. The first half of the story is one about interactions between people, is one about what happens when there's hatred, even when it does have a reason. Right? When you get to a point where people are judging people based on, you know, this past that they have with them that leads them to do all of these crazy things. That's the first half of the story, right? It's just the problem of when there is hatred in society, what ends up happening. The second half of the story is what happens when the leaders don't take a stand on that, right? When the leaders, when the people who are leading your community don't take a stand on the small things, they end up with these really big problems, and when they don't take a stand on those, there's tragedy, right? You see how it just keeps like building on itself. Every little problem, right, keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And I think that what we've seen throughout the sources is all of the different ways that these issues lead to it being everybody's fault, right? Someone, I was talking about this year with someone who was trying to convince me that the story says it's everybody's fault. And I was saying, if you say it's everyone's fault, then it's no one's fault, right? You just basically spread out responsibility, no one takes responsibility for it, nobody gains. But after thinking about it, I sort of am convinced that it is everybody's fault in this story. Every single participant in the story, except for Kamsa, right? Kamsa was guilty by association, but I actually think that that's a really powerful point. Kamsa didn't even make it to the party, but his name is in the one sentence of the reason that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. Because it was a society that was built towards this bad ending, right, of hatred, of leaders who couldn't take a stand, of people who were making, you know, snap judgments and decisions that just ended really, really terribly. There's more to say on this story, if you can believe it, but I want to end, and we also want to take some time to say Tehillim for people who have been learning B'Zchut Refuah Shleimah, so those people who are able to stay, we're just going to take another couple of minutes to do that before we all go home. Thank you guys so much for coming out on a weeknight. I know it wasn't easy, and I love learning from you.
And there will be a recording of this on YU Torah.